Hello, I'm John Dennis. It's Friday the 3rd of July. Today, the convictions of hundreds of men after Britain's biggest ever online paedophilia investigation are to be re-examined by appeal court judges.
The experts involved in these cases have got hold of this website and they claim that it's obvious that there was credit card fraud involved in many, many, many of the cases.
Also today, the first big test for Barack Obama's change of strategy in Afghanistan.
The idea is to put these troops in on the ground in individual villages, keep them there, build outposts and provide protection.
And atheists are pitted against believers for a Turkish television show. But now Bill Overton's got today's headlines and the papers.
The commander of a British regiment has been killed in Afghanistan, the first to have died in active service since the Falklands War 27 years ago. Lieutenant Colonel Rupert Thornelow of 1st Battalion Welsh Guards was killed on Wednesday by what defence officials described last night as a huge bomb that shattered the armoured Viking tracked vehicle he was travelling in. The explosion also killed Trooper Joshua Hammond from 2nd Royal Tank Regiment and injured six others. The soldiers were in a convoy heading for Lashkar Gah, capital of Helmand Province, after completing the second phase of Operation Panther's Claw. The Secretary-General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, has arrived in Burma for a two-day visit. He's due to meet the head of the country's military leaders and has told reporters he'll lobby the junta chief directly for Aung San Suu Kyi's release. The 64-year-old Suu Kyi is charged with violating the terms of her house arrest in a case that has sparked global outrage. Her trial has been adjourned until July the 10th. The ex-wife of Michael Jackson and the mother of two of his children hasn't reached a final decision on whether to seek custody of the children. Debbie Rowe is the mother of Jackson's two eldest, son Michael Joseph Jr., known as Prince Michael, who's 12, and Paris Michael Catherine, who's 11. A memorial for the singer will take place on Tuesday in Los Angeles. Now sport, and at Wimbledon, Andy Murray fights for a place in the finals during his match against the number 6 seed Andy Roddick. If he beats the American, Murray will become the first Brit in 71 years to reach the men's finals at Wimbledon. In the other semi-final match, it's Roger Federer versus Tommy Haas. And now looking at the morning's papers, the death of Lieutenant Colonel Rupert Thornelow features on the front of the Daily Mirror, the Times and the Telegraph, which announces his passing as the death of a leader. The Mail and the case of the British man who hacked into the Pentagon's computers dominates the cover and five pages inside. In its campaign, the paper asks, why is the US using all its might to extradite him? And why, it continues, are our craven politicians doing nothing to help? A spike in oil prices earlier this week was caused by a rogue oil trader, that from the Financial Times. The Chancellor, Alistair Darling, warns that a return of the bonus culture once again threatens the global economy, according to The Independent. And finally, the anger of Michael Jackson fans upon learning that tickets will be sold to attend his funeral will cost £15 a pop is an RIP off, that from The Sun. And those are the headlines today. More news updated throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
Campaigners say hundreds of men have been wrongly convicted of online paedophilia in a mass miscarriage of justice. They were prosecuted as part of Operation Awe, one of the UK's biggest ever investigations into internet child abuse. Well, now they're taking their case to the Court of Appeal. Sandra Laville is The Guardian's crime correspondent.
Operation Awe was one of the biggest online paedophile investigations by police in this country. And it involved the police examining thousands of men who had allegedly downloaded images of children, abusive images of children.
And what happened to the thousands of men who were arrested or prosecuted in connection with this inquiry?
Well, the inquiry started in America and the names of 7,100 individuals were passed to the British police. And over several years, investigations were carried out and about 2,400 of them were convicted of downloading images, either pleading guilty or being convicted in the courts. And they were jailed for months or years. And then there were further investigations into individuals who didn't have images on their computers when police arrived at their homes, but they had been on the list passed over by the Americans.
And they were put on the sex offenders register, and some of them actually committed suicide, didn't they?
It's difficult to estimate how many of those were because they were innocent. Investigators would say once someone is identified and convicted as a paedophile, people take their own lives for that as well.
Now, what's the basis for the claims that the police inquiry was tainted?
or was as a result of an investigation in America in which a couple who ran a paedophile portal website called Landslide were convicted, and out of this came a list of 7,100 individuals. Now, the website has never been seen in full by defence experts in this country, partly because of the size of it and partly because it contained the images it did. But the experts involved in these cases have got hold of this website, and they claim that it's obvious that there was credit card fraud involved in many, many, many of the cases. And they say, therefore, the basis of the evidence is tainted because this wasn't presented in each court case.
It's the first time that these allegations will be examined in an appeal court.
Yeah, they've been making these allegations since 06, actually, and have not yet provided evidence of them. So this is the first time they'll be producing their evidence. They've submitted papers to the Court of Appeal, which is examining it next week.
The police defend the way that the OR inquiry was carried out, though, don't they?
Yeah, they're quite robustly defended, and they say that something like 85% of the downloading convictions were guilty pleas, and that there was a very high correlation between individuals named on the website list and when they were raided in England, images being found on their computers.
What happens if this test case is successful?
Lawyers say that if the test case is successful, hundreds of other cases will fall, the convictions will be dropped because this is mass credit card fraud and it's tainted the whole inquiry.
Sandra Laville, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/UK. Also on The Guardian's website today, Sarah Bosley, The Guardian's health editor, on the spread of swine flu. Find out what the symptoms are and hear the stories of people who've had it and live to tell the tale. guardian.co.uk/swine flu. Jess Cartner-Morley, our fashion editor, on the documentary about Vogue magazine under Anna Winter. It's called The September Issue. Read what she says, guardian.co.uk/media. And Jane Busman, one-time Guardian columnist and now an acclaimed comedian. She talks to Patrick Barkham at guardian.co.uk/culture. In Afghanistan's Helmand province, American troops have launched a major operation in an attempt to turn the tide against the Taliban ahead of next month's elections. Julian Borger, our diplomatic editor, says Operation Kanjar is the first large-scale test of new American tactics and resolve in Afghanistan since Barack Obama took office and declared that the war was his priority.
It's an operation designed to put 4,000 US Marines into two districts in the southern half of Helmand province, in the lower reaches of the Helmand River, and these are districts that have previously been under Taliban control. The idea is to put these troops in on the ground in individual villages, keep them there, build outposts, and provide protection for local residents from the Taliban and convince them that the government in Kabul and its foreign supporters are there to stay. They're not going to be pulling out tomorrow, and try and create a sense of security that will support the elections that are supposed to take place on August the 20th, try and encourage some voter registration, of which there hasn't been much in that part of Helmand.
And what makes this different from previous operations?
Well, there are various elements that are different. I mean, for a start, this is quite significant strength in numbers. I mean, there's 4,000 troops being poured into a relatively small area. So this plugs a hole, if you like. And one of the problems in the past has been NATO would take a village or an area from the Taliban, and then, of course, Taliban would melt away and then come back because NATO wasn't able to hold territory as well as capture it. So there's one of the things that's different is the strength in numbers. The other is the overall approach. These troops have been told the important thing is to protect local civilians, not to kill Taliban. They've been told if there is any kind of risk of killing civilians, to pull back and wait for another opportunity, another occasion to take on the Taliban. The priority is to keep civilians safe. And so there'll be much less aerial bombardment that's been the cause of many of the civilian casualties and much of the disgruntlement with the NATO presence there.
And what are the problems of this kind of approach?
Two main problems are, one, the timing. Why leave it so late? There's only a month or so to go until the elections. If this had happened a year ago, you could imagine that it would be possible to build up the confidence of local population that this was a significant force. They were there and determined to defeat the Taliban, and they were there to stay, or at least the government in Kabul was there to stay. To leave it until really the last moment is leaving it a bit late to build any confidence in the whole electoral process. But that really is a consequence of the fact that the administration has only just changed in the US. It's taken them a few months to put their policy together, change the personnel, change the general at the top in Afghanistan, and to bring this new approach in. Second main problem is this is supposed to be a joint operation with the Afghan army, but in fact it's 4,000 US Marines and about 500 Afghan troops, really a token presence in what was supposed to be a sort of, you know, equal partnership. And the Marines are relying on the Afghan army to fill in behind them, take and hold the areas that they've captured so that they can move on. Now, unless the more Afghan army troops are forthcoming, then the Marines are kind of stuck there and won't be able to reproduce this kind of operation elsewhere in the south and east.
Meanwhile, in a separate development, Julian, it's emerged that insurgents have captured a US soldier in eastern Afghanistan.
Yeah, this is the ultimate nightmare of the US troops there because of it gives Taliban negotiating clout. They're always looking to capture in the hope of using troops as a bargaining chip. Until very recently, they've held an American journalist, David Rode, and one of the aims was, or the presumed aim was, that he would be kept as a bargaining chip to exchange for Taliban detainees in Kabul or elsewhere. But Rode escaped just a few days ago, and so they lost that powerful tool. It's not surprising that they were on the lookout to capture another American to replace that bargaining chip.
Julian Borgia. I'm John Dennis. Coming up in Guardian Daily, Michael Mann, director of Public Enemies, explains why he's fascinated by cops and robbers.
You know, when I was a little kid on Lincoln Avenue and said, oh, there's a biograph. That's where they shot John Dillinger. I said, who's John Dillinger? You know, as a 7, 8, or 9-year-old, you know.
But first, a Turkish television channel, Kanal T, is to broadcast a program that pits a Muslim imam, a Christian priest, a Jewish rabbi, and a Buddhist monk against a panel of non-believers. Adverts for the programme, which is called Penitents Compete, bear the legend, "We give you the biggest prize ever. We represent the belief in God." In Istanbul, with the details, is Robert Tate.
The way it will work is that each episode of the programme will have 10 contestants, 10 atheists, and these have to be hardcore non-believers, so they'll be assessed for the strength and intensity of their non-belief before they're allowed to take part. And they will be up against four clerics of different faiths, one from Islam, one from Christianity, a rabbi from Judaism, and a Buddhist monk. And each of these four clerics will have the task of trying to persuade the participants of converting to their faith. If they succeed in doing so, each convert will have the chance of going on a pilgrimage to the creed, the newfound creed of their choice.
And what happens if one of the atheists convinces the believers that God doesn't exist?
That has not been disclosed. I think there is no prizes for doing that. I think the object of the exercise is to make people move in the opposite direction. There is no prize, I think, given Turkey's religious spirit and the widespread religious belief which many people hold here. There is no prize for persuading clerics, or indeed persuading anybody, that God doesn't exist. I think this is very much an exercise that moves in the one direction.
To put it mildly, this has the potential to cause offence, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Some people in Turkey have described the whole exercise as inappropriate. They think it belittles the whole idea of religious faith and the existence of God. Certainly the provincial head of the Religious Affairs Directorate has said that a TV game show is not an appropriate setting to discuss such matters. Other people, you know, the sort of what you might describe as the atheist minority or secular set of the population may also see it as pandering to a sort of widespread prejudice that many Turks hold against atheists. So there's a recent survey carried out by a university here in Istanbul which suggested that 3 out of 4 Turks would object to living next door to an atheist or to one who drinks alcohol, the two being somehow seen as representing the same thing.
Robert Tait. Well, it's Andy Murray's first ever Wimbledon semi-final today. Britain's number one takes on Andy Roddick. It's fair to say there's a certain amount of interest in the match. I mean, Gibson, the Guardian sports correspondent, is at Wimbledon.
The atmosphere very much building and, you know, all leading towards that potential final on Sunday.
And if Murray beats Roddick, the queues will be something to see, won't they?
Well, that's the interesting thing, actually, is that, you know, by that point, the tickets will all have been allocated and there'll be very little to queue for. So, actually, I don't think we'll see the television news pictures of the long, snaking queues.
What will Murray have to do to beat Roddick today?
Well, he's got a very good record against him. He's 6-2 in terms of their previous meetings. And psychologically, I think that obviously gives him the upper hand. Roddick's obviously a fantastic server. Murray's one of the best returners of the ball in the game, so it should all add up to a very good match. But I mean, all the experts, all the other players on the tour seem to think that Murray's a favourite. I think what Roddick does have over him is obviously experience. He's been in more semi-finals, he's been in more Grand Slams, and a sense, I think he's got a real sort of fighting spirit, and he's often at his best when he's a little bit sort of backed up against the wall. So the fact that Murray's got the entire 15,000 people on centre court and millions around the country willing him on won't necessarily work in his favour in this case, I think.
Well, as you say, that the country's willing him on, and as I'm sure you're tired of hearing, it's 73 years since a Briton last won Wimbledon. I mean, the pressure on Murray must be unbelievable.
Well, it is, you know, it's incredible, really, and the way he's handling it so far this fortnight has been amazing too. I mean, he seems very much untroubled by it. He's a much more relaxed figure. I mean, he's still fairly dour in his press conferences, if I'm honest, but he cuts a much more relaxed figure than he has done in previous years. You often see him laughing and joking with this team he's got around him, which I think has really relaxed him. And as you say, the pressure is building and will only build more if he wins today. But so far, I'd say it seems to be spurring him on rather than getting to him.
And if he does win today, he's probably going to face Federer in the final. I mean, we're talking about possibly the best tennis player ever, aren't we?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, Federer's looked awesome this week, to be honest. He's moved through each round with the clinical ease and with a slight air of kind of nonchalance, honest. It's looked very easy for him, but obviously Murray's beaten him several times in the past and we'll be able to give him a very good game. I mean, you just worry that Federer's extra kind of experience of centre courts and finals might tell, but obviously he's got to beat Tsitsipas first, and that's no foregone conclusion. It would be a major shock if Federer wasn't in the final, and he's going for his 15th career Grand Slam, which would be a record too. So it'd be a fantastic story, and you know, the dream final in many ways if it was a Federer-Murray final.
Owen Gibson. Public Enemies is the new film from Michael Mann, starring Johnny Depp as the Chicago gangster John Dillinger on the run from Sheriff Christian Bale. It was described by the New York Times as a grave and beautiful work of art. Mann spoke to Jason Solomons for this week's Film Weekly podcast.
Well, these kinds of stories they're native to Chicago. So is the attitude. Chicago's always had a very tough-minded, skeptical kind of humor. If you think back to My Girl Friday and Front Page, yeah. And Hecht, and it's kind of a Brechtian wit on the street in Chicago, right. Amongst all Chicagoans. That's not reserved to.
Well, why is that? Because it's not New York, and because it's not LA, because it's sort of
not at all. Not at all. Chicago has its own identity. It's not the middle of anywhere. Mm. It's a tough. It's a very beautiful city, physically very beautiful city, and it's a tough city. It's had a tough history, and it's a very strongly populous city. So it happens to be going through a stage right now, by the way, where it's probably the best run and most physically beautiful city in America. Mm-hmm. And if anybody walked down the street just about anywhere in that city and put graffiti on the walls, the citizens would interfere. I mean, it's a really
Because in your new film, you use it to its kind of shiniest and I suppose most grand, go harking back to that 30s.
In this film, it harkens back to the brick streets and brick buildings and that reality. It very much occurs in a neighborhood that I grew up in. I drove past the Biograph Theater with my father, and when I was a little kid on Lincoln Avenue, and said, "Oh, there's a Biograph. That's where they shot John Dillinger." I said, "Who's John Dillinger?" As a 7, 8, or 9 year old, And so it's the neighborhood, not just of the physically, but also culturally. Mm-hmm. Dillinger was admired. He was a kind of a folk hero in his time, and that's absolutely. There's nothing remarkable about that to Chicagoans. Chicagoans have always appreciated the machine politics of Mayor Daley, for example, mm-hmm. because it's responsive and it works. So it's a very populist kind of a.
What's the Chicagoan relationship with gangsterism in itself? I mean, with, say, Al Capone, for example. No, did they treat all gangsters the same way, or John Dillinger particularly had a kind of Robin Hood?
Well, you're talking about two very different things. I mean, Al Capone is a prehistory of organized crime. And they made massive amounts of cash, accrued massive amounts of cash during Prohibition. Mm. They were selling a product. You had to smuggle that product in or manufacture it, distribute it, sell it. There's a lot of exposure. When Prohibition ends in 1933, it's become one of the major antagonists to John Dillinger in the film. When Prohibition ended in 1933, these guys were sitting there and they were cash rich, and they evolved their business. And Frank Nitti, who was quite bright, moved organized crime into corporate capitalism. And many people view the earlier stage, the Capone stage, as kind of the robber baron phase of capital evolution.
Right.
And then it moved into a whole different stage, into basically white-collar organized crime, in which case the idea of having these entertaining celebrity 19th-century bandits floating around generating all kinds of heat in the media was a bad idea.
But what is the fascination with guns in your work? I mean, it is they are always it always comes down to a good gun battle. I mean, your main characters are kind of always right. armed very very well, I think, and kind of enjoy the steel of the weapon, and that's sort of been a thing in your work. I didn't know if that's
I disagree. Work. It hasn't really been a thing in my work. If you're doing a story on John Dillinger, who was really well armed with the best and made a lot of innovations in a weaponry, then you're doing something on John Dillinger. If I'm doing something on like Insider on Jeffrey Wigand and journalist Lowell Bergman, there are no guns.
But I mean, heat there is tremendous.
But it's a lethal kind of a lethal kind of conflict. Jeffrey Wigand's case destroyed his family, took him to the verge of suicide. Mm-hmm. So what I'm interested in is conflict, extreme conflict, men who find themselves in extreme circumstances to the point where it really threatens, who they are, point of annihilation.
Michael Mann, and there's more from him and from Jason Solomons on Film Weekly at guardian.co.uk/film. Phil Maynard and Roxanne Escobales produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.